Today at Reader's Corner, James Hansen, author of Storms of My Grandchildren, The Truth About the Coming Climate Change Catastrophe and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity.
The fact is that as long as fossil fuels are the cheapest energy, we won't stop burning them and we won't solve the problem. What we need is a gradually rising price on carbon emissions. But the money should be collected from the fossil fuel companies and then divided among the public. Money talks in Washington and other capitals, and that's the basic problem. There's just too much power in the lobbying and the money.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Scientists have been sounding the global warming alarm for decades. Today's guest, James Hansen, was one of the first to do so, and he's more passionate now than ever. Dr. Hansen is perhaps best known for bringing global warming to the world's attention in the 1980s when he testified before Congress. His call for change intensified with the release of his first book, Storms of My Grandchildren, The Truth About the Coming Climate Change Catastrophe and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity. A leading expert on climate issues, Dr. Hansen's background in both space and earth sciences allows a broad perspective on the status and prospects of our planet. He is director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies and an adjunct professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Columbia University and at Columbia's Earth Institute. His articles have been published in The Nation, Scientific American, and the New York Times Review of Books, and he has been the subject of news stories and profiles in major newspapers and on television. Now out in paperback, Storms of My Grandchildren earned the 2011 Green Book Award, the Royal Society 2010 Prize for Science Books, and the 2010 Sophie Prize. Dr. Hansen joins us today by phone for this interview. Jim Hansen, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, it's interesting talking to somebody who has had the book out a couple of years. Oftentimes we do these interviews just months after it hits the bookshelves. And in this particular case, you've had a couple of years to assess the reaction. I'm sure that your book, I wonder to what extent you feel it's moved the needle among the doubting Thomases. Not just your book, but what's happened in the last 2 years. Has there been any movement in helping folks understand the gravity of this situation?
Well, you know, that is the unfortunate thing. The science has become clearer and clearer, even over just the last couple of years. But yet the public's recognition of the situation has not improved. And for very good reasons, you know, the people who want to continue business as usual have been very successful in confusing the situation by making it appear that, well, we don't know for sure if we understand the science, while in fact it has become clearer and clearer. So, and the problem is that we're running out of time. That's why it's really becoming critical that the public get a better understanding.
When you say we're running out of time and you subtitle your book, Our Last Chance to Save Humanity, it's pretty scary. How close are we to the point of no return when it comes to climate change?
Well, the problem is that we need to change our energy systems, which will take a matter of decades. And it's hard to say when you've passed tipping points like the ice sheet's stability. But once we reach a certain point where, say, the ice sheets begin to disintegrate, then you can have a situation that's out of your control, because even if you then begin to phase out your CO2 emissions, you just can't do it fast enough to stop that dynamic process from continuing. And it's not only ice sheets and sea level, but we're putting pressure on all the species on the planet as we cause climate to change at a more rapid rate than it naturally would change. We drive some species to extinction, and we're doing other things to put pressure on species. So the danger there is that you'll drive enough species to extinction that, because of their interdependencies, you can get ecosystems that begin to collapse, and we will drive a large fraction of the species on the planet to extinction. So it's just very hard to say, though, when you've reached the point where the dynamics of that sort of system will take over. But as clear that we're very near that point.
Well, there seems to be some evidence that the polar bear is threatened by in the Arctic from the...
Yeah, that's an example. The polar species and the mountain species will be pushed off the planet because we'll just shift to the climate zone such that the climates that they can live in won't exist.
One of the things that does make it confusing for the average layman who just doesn't have the time or the interest in reading the science or learning about it is being confronted with what we had here in Idaho this year. Lots of snow and precipitation over the winter and a cold, wet spring. And how many times have we heard the pedestrian response to that? Yeah, this is global warming, right? I guess I have two questions about that. Number one, how do you, as a scientist, help the layman understand the difference between weather fluctuations and climate change? And when it comes to that word climate change, is that not the better term to be using these days as opposed to global warming because of these incredible shifts that sometimes brings cold as well as hot?
Yeah, that is a difficulty because the weather fluctuations so far, which can be tens of degrees, are larger than the shift in the average global temperature. So we try to show graphs, you know, for example, which will illustrate that although you still have these fluctuations, if you look at the mean over a decade or over a few years, you see that, in fact, it is shifting. The noise, this natural variability, is larger in the winter than it is in the summer. You know, I'd realized when I testified in the 1980s that this was going to be an issue, and that's why I used colored dice to show that, well, what's happening is as you get warming, you shift the odds. You'll get more frequent high temperatures, but still there will be some times when it's colder than average, colder than the climatology. But the frequency of that will become less. And especially that's especially true in the summer because the natural variability in the summer is much smaller. And if we now look at maps of temperature anomalies, we see that in the last several years, the summers have had 30 to 40% of the world covered with summer temperature anomalies that occurred only 2% of the time or 2% of the area in the last half of the last century. So the climate is shifting, but it's hard for the person in the street to recognize that unless they're willing to average over some time period. But we can see that the extreme events are occurring more frequently.
And I'm fascinated by the people who would have to agree with you just looking at the data, and yet, as you say in your book, are still global warming contrarians. In fact, you refer to a gentleman, a member of the faculty at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I think his name is Richard Lynch, and you call him the dean of global warming contrarians. And you say that he has impressive scholarly credentials. But I just wonder whether or not you are picking up any ground. If the science is becoming stronger, then why wouldn't scientists like this guy, who does have these impressive scholarly credentials, come into the fold?
Well, there are a few people who, you know, are not going to change their position regardless of the evidence. But, you know, if you put Richard Lindzen in a group of National Academy of Science members, you know, I was on a committee with him, which had to write a report on this subject for the Bush administration. And in that group, he does not really deny the basic facts. And, of course, the report had a very clear message that humans are changing the climate. The evidence is clear on that, and we're going to need to reduce carbon dioxide emissions if we hope to stabilize the climate. But, you know, I also mentioned in the book that Richard Lindzen testified against the evidence that smoking caused lung cancer. And recently when I asked him about that, he still denies that evidence. So you're just not going to change his mind. But all you have to do is ask an authoritative body like the National Academy of Sciences or the American Geophysical Union or any of the top scientific organizations, and they will give you a very clear answer that, in fact, humans are now the major forcing factor that's driving future climate.
And then, of course, the next question is, what are we going to do about it? And there,
that's the important point, because the things that need to be done actually make sense for other reasons. If we want to solve our fossil fuel addiction and become energy independent from the oil producing nations, the actions that we need to make and move to clean energies actually make sense. But the fact is that as long as fossil fuels are the cheapest energy, we won't stop burning them and we won't solve the problem. So what we need to do is put a gradually rising price on fossil fuel emissions by collecting a fee from the fossil fuel companies at the domestic mine or the port of entry. And if that money were then distributed to the public so that they would have the means to make the kind of changes in their lifestyle, and next time they buy a vehicle, get a more energy efficient one, then we could move the economy in a way that we would be able to solve the problem. But we, as long as we're subsidizing fossil fuels and not making them pay for their cost to society, then we can't solve the problem.
Well, and that's where it really gets depressing, because it certainly doesn't seem like anyone is making much of a dent in the policy-making world. Is there anything that's happened? What's happened in the last 2 years since your book's come out that might give us a hint of some understanding from policymakers that we've got a problem we've got to get to here?
Well, in the U.S., we're doing some things like requiring more efficient vehicles, and even the automobile manufacturers are finally coming around and agreeing that they should be producing more efficient vehicles. But unless we put a price on those emissions, we won't solve the problem. However, what's encouraging is that some other countries like China, which has become the principal emitter of carbon dioxide, they seem to understand the problem and do not deny the science. So they have become number one producers of solar energy, wind energy, and new nuclear power plants. And I think that they are now considering putting a tax on carbon emissions, which is what you have to do if you want to cause society to phase down the use of fossil fuels and increase the use of clean energies.
You're listening to James Hansen. He's the author of Storms of My Grandchildren, The Truth About the Coming Climate Catastrophe and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity. What role does nuclear technology play in this challenge, Jim?
Well, for countries like China and India, it's absolutely essential. They are heavily reliant on coal for their electricity. And there's just no other option at this time for baseload electric power. Despite all the subsidies and encouragement of the renewable energies, the fraction of electricity generation from renewables is only a couple of percent, and it's intermittent. So in many countries, I think nuclear is essential. And what does not seem to be understood, it's really very unfortunate, the way the media has handled the Fukushima nuclear accident, which was not really a nuclear accident. It was an earthquake and a tsunami, with a 10-meter tsunami that washed over nuclear power plants. And these were 50-year-old plants that were not designed to withstand a 10-meter tsunami. Actually, they survived the earthquake, but then they lost their power. Well, the new generations of nuclear power plant would not have had the problems that those did, because the new generation has passive cooling. It doesn't require power to continue to cool the nuclear fuel. And the fourth generation nuclear power, which can burn nuclear waste, is the thing that we will really need on the long run, because that will solve the biggest problem with nuclear power, namely dealing with the nuclear waste, which the fourth generation power plants can burn. The current generation burns less than 1% of the energy in the nuclear fuel and leaves the rest of it in a waste pile with a 10,000-year half-life. But that problem can be solved. And I think that that's necessary if we're going to be able to phase off of coal for electricity.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about clean coal technology. You have some thoughts on that.
Well, there is no such thing as clean coal. You know, that's just an advertising slogan.
Right.
It's very dirty in the mining process, and you know, coal kills more than 100,000 people a year, while, you know, nuclear power in the United States, for example, has never killed anybody. It has the best safety record of any energy in the country. But, yeah, they use that slogan about clean coal, but in fact there is no such thing.
Well, some countries have pledged to build power plants that are carbon capture ready. What does that mean? And is it viable?
Well, yeah, that if you really wanted to stop the emissions from coal at the power plants, in principle you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
You can't solve the mining problems, but at the power plant you could capture the emissions and then store the carbon dioxide underground. But that's going to add a cost to the electricity generation, which would make coal uncompetitive.
The Congress pursued a cap-and-trade system. It's been very controversial. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, the cap-and-trade is a system designed by and for the benefit of big banks and the fossil fuel industry. What we actually need, cap-and-trade necessarily brings the big banks into the situation, because you were talking about trillions of dollars for this energy market, and the money for that is going to be moving through the banks, and they have these highly skilled trading units. So when you trade something like carbon emissions on a marketplace, they will make a lot of money that way. But where does the money come from? It comes from increased energy prices for the public, and there's no reason to break the banks into this. What we need is a gradually rising price on carbon emissions so that we can phase out our addiction to fossil fuels. But the money should be collected from the fossil fuel companies at the mine or domestic mine or the port of entry, and then the money should be divided among the public, an equal amount on a per capita basis to the legal residents of the country. If you did that, by the time that fee got to the equivalent of $1 a gallon of gasoline, it would be generating an amount of money which would allow you to give $2,000 to $3,000 per citizen. And that would increase the cost of gas at the pump by, you know, $1 a gallon. But the public would be getting this dividend, and those people who do better than average in limiting their carbon footprint would actually get more in this monthly dividend than they would pay in increased energy prices.
Boy, that sure takes a pretty enlightened voter and motorist to buy into that line of thinking. I'm all with you. I'm on your side. But, boy, that's tough, especially when we have people out in Congress.
There's an organization called Republicans for the Environment.
Uh-huh.
And the head of that wrote an article about this. And he said, that's actually the conservative approach, because it lets the marketplace make the decisions. That once the business community knows that the carbon prices are going to go up, then you'll get all kinds of innovations. And the people who then pay attention to that, can actually make reduce their net cost, provided that the money is given to the public rather than to the fossil fuel companies or the big banks. And that could be explained. I mean, as Jim DePeso, who's the head of that organization, said, it could be explained in a one-minute elevator speech. And the public, it could understand that. But if you talk about things like cap and trade with offsets, complicated things that are really designed by the banks and the fossil fuel industry, then you'll never sell that.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that fascinates me about your book is that if anybody really wants to understand the science behind climate change and why it makes so much sense if you just follow the science, you'll get it in your book. But you're an interesting guy in the sense that you're a scientist who scientists normally don't step out of their roles as scientists and become the policy advocate that you have. And back when President Bush was in office, there was the Kyoto approach to international climate treaty making, and he was criticized for not signing it. And I'm sure you may or may not have been one criticizing him because, frankly, I don't think you thought much of that. But you don't think much more of the Obama administration on this. You're kind of an equal opportunity critic, it looks like to me. And help us understand your role as a critic and a scientist.
Well, yeah, there's a very good reason for that, because what I learned, and that's the reason I started speaking out, was that the governments, many of them, have learned to say the right words. It's what I call greenwash. They will say that we have a planet in peril, and yet then if you look at their actions, they're in fact not doing anything that is effective. So I make the simple graphs, you know, that show how the emissions have changed. The emissions went up faster in the Clinton-Gore administration than in the Bush administration. So there's no one who's actually addressing the problem. Instead, they come up with these gimmicks, you know, the cap and trade with offsets, while they don't address the fundamental fact that as long as fossil fuels are the cheapest energy, somebody will keep burning them. So you have to address that. You know, the scientists can connect the dots, and when we do connect them in an objective way, we see that the policymakers are not, in fact, doing anything to solve the problem.
So what's your experience with the Obama administration? Or what's your thoughts on their approach?
Well, yeah, I had hoped. I wrote a letter to the president after he was elected and before he took office and tried to make this situation clear and the fact that the problem, climate problem, could be solved in a way that solves the really big issues with our energy independence and our financial security, our national security. But policies, in fact, have not changed that much. We're still allowing fossil fuel companies to call the tune.
Well, I think you've identified the fact that there's quite a few of those energy lobbyists out in Washington.
Yeah, there are five of them for every congressperson in Washington. And money talks in Washington and other capitals, and that's the basic problem. Governments are supposed to be responsible to the public, but the way it's worked, there's just too much power in the lobbying and the money.
To the extent that it is going to take a preponderance of opinion and science to move the needle on this issue. Your book, of course, created quite the buzz, but I wonder how we monitor this progress. It's my understanding that you're working on some kind of a website that will help people follow this issue and survey the mounting data that comes in every year.
Yeah, the data is not that complicated, and so I do update the graphs. My approach was to try to introduce a little science in each chapter and have simple graphs that show how different physical quantities are changing, but also our fossil fuel use. And the data that allows people to keep track of both the climate and how well we're doing in addressing that. It's, you know, it's hard to get the public to pay attention to this sort of thing, but I think they have to do that if we're going to be able to put the pressure on the governments to do the right thing.
And what's the name of that website? Is that Updating the Climate Science?
Yeah, it's on my Columbia University website. They can find it by Googling my name, James Hansen.
Well, to the extent that we're trying to move the needle, as I said earlier, I wonder to what extent it helps to have NASA front and center. The Goddard Center you work with, where is NASA on this issue? They certainly must be gathering data that stands alongside what you have and others have. Given how authoritative NASA is and the degree of confidence I assume the American people have in NASA, does NASA have an advocacy role here to be played?
No. NASA does the science. It does the climate science, but it doesn't take policy positions. But we do observe the planet and provide data on how things are changing, including global temperature and precipitation and various other climate quantities. But, you know, I carefully separate my statements related to policy, and I don't, in my daily job with NASA, I'm careful to just do the science.
And you don't get any grief about that from them?
Well, I get a lot of grief in the sense that people who prefer to continue business as usual would criticize me, but I think I'm careful to try to separate my role. It is a free country, and I am allowed to express my opinions, and so it's continuing effort to say what I think is important, but not do it inappropriately.
You've urged the American people to get involved, to make a statement, and you have something called the Declaration of Stewardship. We're just about out of time, but I would like you to comment on that and perhaps give our listeners who are interested a place to go.
Yeah, well, that I wrote something before the last election, but we're going to be coming up on new elections, and I think people should be asking the candidates about their position and asking them to make a declaration that they will support those actions which will preserve a climate and creation for future generations. Because at the present, the politician is just looking at the next election and not having much concern about what our children are going to inherit.
Well, as we tape this show during the debt ceiling crisis and debate and lack of action, I don't think not many people can disagree with you on that one, Jim. Again, we've run out of time, but I sure appreciate your joining us today on Reader's Corner. Thanks for being with
us. Thanks very much.
It's James Hansen, author of Storms of My Grandchildren, The Truth About the Coming Climate Catastrophe and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity. Next week, Joseph Nye, author of The Future of Power, An Analysis of Power Among Nations in the 21st Century and How Smart Power Strategies Must Include More Than Military Strength. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.